Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Kickstarter Spotlight episode, and we're going to be talking about a true crime campaign that's going on right now. And it's my pleasure to welcome the creator, Ed Brisson, to the show. Ed, thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, like we were saying before we got started here, Ed has been on before to talk a little extermination at New York Comic Con, but this is the first time he's officially been on the show. So before we get into kind of the campaign, and he's going to let you know all about Catch and Release, we want to give him a chance to give kind of his secret origin as we do when someone's on the show for the first time. So Ed, tell us about comics in your childhood. Were they always a big part of your childhood? Did you grow up reading them? How did you fall in love with the medium?
Yeah, I've read comics pretty much as far back as I can remember. I started really collecting comics when I was maybe 8. My mom used to drag us to the used bookstore every weekend and would, you know, set us down right by the front door of the store. There was a bunch of long boxes of 10-cent comics, and I would usually blow my weekly allowance on 10-cent comics. Starting out with Peter Porker, the Spectacular Spider-Ham, and Captain Carrot, and all that sort of stuff. And then sort of moving up on into like Spider-Man, Secret Wars was a massive thing a little bit later for me. Punisher, Daredevil, Batman. I was really into G.I. Joe and Transformers. Those 80s series were great. And then Nom was another favorite back then. So yeah, from the time I was 8, I was basically just consuming comics at a pretty rapid pace. Blowing all my allowance money on them, and still several, I won't say how many years later, but several years later, I'm still doing it, still reading them, but thankfully also writing them these days.
Yeah, sounds like you're mostly a Marvel guy. Was there any DC that interested you beyond Batman?
Batman and the sort of Batman family of stuff was a big one for me. I liked Manhunter a lot. That was one I read. The Ray, whenever The Ray came out, I know that was sort of like a a short run. Justice League Europe, I was a really big fan of. For some reason, I never got into any of the other Justice Leagues, but Justice League Europe. was my one growing up. And I read Superman as well for quite a while. But Batman, like, I always tend to gravitate towards dark and broody. And so Batman, you know, suits that quite well.
Yeah, that's true. Plus kind of the crime aspect too.
Sure.
At what point did you start thinking, hey, maybe I want to become a creator? I mean, I remember reading comics as a kid, not even putting two and two together of thinking there's people out there on the other end creating this, you know, making a living, sometimes not that great of a living back then. But at what point did you start thinking, hey, maybe this is something I want to pursue as a career?
I think it wasn't until I hit high school. I was always drawing when I was younger. So I was by the Marvel Universe magazines that had it was great because it had just the characters in pose, in standing poses. And I would just sort of look at those and try and replicate them. And then later on try and draw my own comics. But I think it was roughly when I hit high school, there was a few things. And one, there was just that, you know, you recognize the names before, when I was younger, I would recognize some of the names popping up in a lot of books I was reading. But I don't think it was until I was about 13, 14, that I really started to sort of follow creators more than as much as I did characters. And right around that time was when Todd McFarlane sort of really blew up as well. And up until then, I'd sort of had this idea in my head that you had to live in New York to be a comic book creator, and being a kid living up in Canada and at that point on the other side of the country, it just didn't seem very feasible that I would ever move to New York. It seemed completely foreign. It's like moving to the moon,
right?
But when I saw, you know, Todd McFarlane was huge and was Canadian, and it made me realize that, you know, maybe it was possible for me. And at this point I was focused only on being an artist. I wanted to be an artist. And so, yeah, when I was about 14, I started just drawing comics, you know, for myself, trying to create more frequently. When I, towards the end of high school, I sort of created my own characters and would sort of write and draw stories with them. And then when I got out of high school, by the time I was done high school, I knew I wanted to be a comic book artist. That was my career goal, was comic book artist. And so I went to fine arts and I would start self-publishing comics. Back in 1994, I started self-publishing comics. And I initially only started writing because I didn't know any writers. And I met one, actually two, but they almost the same person in a lot of ways through local comic shops. When I was living in Kelowna, which is up in British Columbia. And both of these guys, it was just a really bad experience. I met these two guys who wanted to be writers separately in two different things. But both of them had this sort of idea that they were, that what I was working on was theirs. Even though they weren't going to be paying me or anything, it was their idea. They owned it. You know, I was sort of just a guy who would bring their dreams to life, almost like as if my contribution didn't matter. And also, they weren't great writers. They really loved these terrible ideas that they had. I remember one of them, literally the end of his first issue, or the story that he'd written, the main character wakes up and the whole thing was a dream. So I realized then that I would just
cliche.
It was bad, but I realized, you know, this is pre-internet, so I thought, you know, screw it, I can just write scripts myself. You know, I knew I could write at least as well as they could, so I just started writing scripts for myself to draw. Around that same time, I went to fine arts in university to sort of hone my skills. I never graduated from fine arts. I ended up dropping out along the way. But I focused for years from 1994 until 2010, just self-publishing mini comics, or what some people, I guess, called ash cans, which are, you know, 8.5 by 11 photocopies stapled down the center. I would sell those through local record shops or out of my backpack even. And I did that for a long time and then just realized one day that I much prefer writing. I wasn't so crazy about drawing or being a comic book illustrator. And it was the writing where my passion really lay. So in 2010, I just stopped drawing and focused on writing. And within 2 years, I had a book at Image. And then a year after that, I think, is when I did my first Marvel work. And then it's, you know, just kept going from there.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know a few creators who've started that way. Scott Snyder, you know, he always thought he was going to be an artist and then fell in love with the writing side of things. I find it interesting. Do you think because you honed your skills in storytelling visually first with that sequential art, do you feel like that made it easier for you when you decided, hey, I'm going to write my own scripts? You know, did you come at it from, hey, I'm writing this from a visual standpoint, and then your writing evolved from there?
I think so. I think it helps me communicate with artists a lot easier because I know, you know, I know the language, I guess. And there's a lot of, like, you know, as you mentioned, there's a ton of writers who we are all just frustrated artists. We wanted to be artists and just weren't able to hack it, but somehow were able to pull off the writing side of things. But I think that... Yeah, I can understand the visual language behind it. I can sort of, I think, better convey my ideas to an artist as opposed to someone who doesn't have any sort of art background. And I think, you know, I know what to ask for when I'm sitting down to write a script.
Yeah, that's really cool that you were inspired by your fellow Canadian, Todd McFarlane. I live in Phoenix. He lives in Phoenix, so I run into him from time to time. And then, of course, I've seen him at shows. Have you ever gotten the chance to meet him and let him know that he kind of inspired you to head down that path?
No. So just before this pandemic, I was at a convention in Vancouver, and I was in an elevator going up to my room with my wife and kid. And it opened on the second floor, and Todd McFarlane and his dad got in. And we ended up riding up five floors or whatever it was together. And when we got off the elevator, I tend to get quiet in those sort of situations. I'm not a super outgoing person, so I'm not somebody who's going to walk up and introduce myself. But my wife knows me, you know, we've been together 20 plus years, so she knows me well enough to know when something's up. And I remember I was getting off the elevator and she's like, what's wrong? What's going on? And I was just like, I can't talk right now. I can't talk. Cause he was literally like, you know, a few feet in front of us. And it turned out his room was right across the hall from us. So yeah, when I got back to the room, I was like, oh my God, that was Todd McFarlane. And it was kind of funny because it's, you know, I work in the industry now, but that sort of, you know, being starstruck doesn't necessarily go away. So no, I've never spoken to him. I didn't have the courage to say anything at that point.
Well, if we're ever at a show together, because like I said, I know Todd, we'll have to make that happen. That
would be all right.
Really cool. I'll introduce you, then kind of fade away into the background. Because honestly, I love Todd. He's the best. You don't really need to say much. Todd will totally handle the conversation.
I've heard that. Yeah.
Yeah. He definitely.
Yeah. I met years and years and years ago when I was really in '94 when I started self-publishing. I met somebody who had worked with Todd a lot, and I believe was the best man at Todd's wedding. He was also a comic book artist who hasn't done anything for years, I don't think, but he used to go by Spider Hansen. And I'm totally blanking on what his real first name is, but you know, he drew Nomad and stuff back in the 90s. Was a Canadian guy living up in Victoria. But I remember even being that close to you know, the sphere of Todd McFarlane was nerve-wracking for me.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, let's transition here. Let's talk a little bit about your Kickstarter project that you have going on, Catch and Release. Why don't you let our listeners know what it's about? What's kind of the elevator pitch for this story?
So yeah, the basic pitch is that Catch and Release is about a man who sort of used to be a bit of a delinquent, I guess. Used to be a bit of a troublemaker, but he's kind of on the He's kind of got his life together, but with the pandemic and everything, which the pandemic only plays a really small role in the story, because I know that coming out of this, we're going to be inundated with pandemic stories. But he's kind of in a financial crunch. You know, he's about to get kicked out of his house because he's behind on rent by 3 months. He's, you know, he owes money to his wife. His bills have all stacked up. And he's just sort of frustrated, and he steals a car. But not for any real reason other than just, I think, to feel in control, you know, to feel like he's still got it. He can still do this thing. But now that he's got a stolen car, he's got to do something with it. And his friend convinces him that what they ought to do is they can't actually sell the car because they don't have proper papers for it. So they decide that they're going to list it for sale and lure unsuspecting buyers out to sort of a remote location to purchase this car, and then rob them for the money that they brought to buy this car with at gunpoint. So that's sort of that's the setup for the story. That's where we kind of kick off. And where the story really gets going is when we have a buyer. There's a student named Samar who is about to drive cross country to go to school, start his new life on the West Coast. His car dies like 2 days before he's supposed to go. So he's desperate to get a new car. He's got the money in his pocket. He sees this listing, which seems almost too good to be true. Obviously it is. And he drags a friend out there to buy this car. They find themselves at the wrong end of a gun. And the story is really about the fallout of that robbery. What happens after, which I don't want to spoil too much, but that's the inciting incident. And it's four different people whose lives are completely changed because of this one incident. Not all of them actually make it out of this situation, and the story is really about our protagonist, the car thief, having to sort of decide, you know, who he wants to be, what he wants to be, like what kind of man he wants to be, and how far he's going to push this crime in the hopes of escaping unscathed, and realizing that he's not going to. He's going to come out dirty and has to decide how dirty he wants to get.
Yeah, so it sounds so interesting. I read the premise. It was familiar with what the idea was. But hearing you describe it, I don't know if you're familiar. It's a pretty famous novel, The Bridge Over San Luis Rey, where, again, mm-hmm. there's that, you know, initial incident. All these people die when a bridge collapses. And then you kind of go back and look at what their lives are. In a way, you're talking about kind of this, you know, it reminds me of the story you're telling here. You're talking about these four separate individuals who are kind of tied together by this event. But then really what the story is about is, okay, what happens next? Let's follow each of their storylines and see where it goes and kind of see how they all react to a similar incident. So I find that to be really interesting. And the other aspect of it is how it can all relate. Cause we all have that moment or moments in our life where you can look back years later and go, man, that I didn't realize it at the time, how kind of impactful or important that moment is. And you always talk about that the best stories are about putting ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. And again, when something impactful happens in our life that's sort of extraordinary, we're too close to it. We can't see how it impacts until years down the line. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting that you mentioned the way that that book is structured. I haven't actually read that book. I'll get the name again from you later on. But because I, interestingly, we do something similar with this book in that it has the inciting incident, and then we actually flash back on both sides. So there's really like two sides to the story, which is the student buying the car and his friend Alex, and then the car thief named Andrew and his friend Chris. And we do flash back and get the story of what brought them to this moment. Mm-hmm. And then we you know, go forward with the story. So yeah, that's interesting. But I'm always really interested in terms of crime stuff, more than the crime itself, I'm always interested in what brought the person perpetrating the crime to that point. You know, I think it's really easy to just say bad people are bad, but you know, more often than not, there's a reason that they're here, and it's, you know, generally tragic, you know, like it's not always just a conscious choice to go out there and become a criminal. It's just a need to survive, which brings those people there, which brings our characters there anyway.
Yeah. Well, I think especially when you talk about a story like this, where you know, you have an event that's rooted in violence, although that can be exciting in the moment, you know, it's kind of like an action story where it's kind of like, you know, eye candy, if you will, or, you know, big popcorn flick. It's exciting in the moment because it's, you know, flashy and cool to look at, but there's nothing that lasts unless you can make it relatable, unless you can make it interesting, because that interest of seeing a big explosion or a cool stunt is cool in that moment. But after that, it's like, how much does it really matter unless you're invested? So the interesting part is the motivation and looking back at, you know, if just this one little thing had happened a split second later or earlier in that person's life, all the infinite possibilities that can come from that.
Absolutely. No, and this whole thing, like the violent incident happens fairly early on in the story. And it the story really is about the fallout and how everyone copes after everything goes down.
And this book is kind of set in the world of your murder book, kind of overall umbrella. Do you want to kind of explain to our listeners what that's about?
Sure. Yeah. So earlier on when I was talking about when I quit drawing and just focused on writing, I did that on my birthday in 2010. Like I made a very like sort of a deliberate decision that this is what I was going to do, no longer draw, just write. And I sat down that day and I wrote my first, or at least the first draft of my first murder book story, which is called Catching Up. And basically what Murder Book became was a series of short stories. They're all short crime stories, usually with some sort of like, you know, Twilight Zone-y twist at the end. Not in that it's a supernatural twist, but something that happens to the characters later in the story that would sort of recontextualizes what had happened previous. So they were all like short crime stories, five to the longest one, I believe, is 21 pages that I did over the series of about 5-6 years, working with various artists. And then, you know, I sort of put it on hold because I was doing a lot of work for Marvel, you know, where I'm still doing a lot of work for Marvel and work for other publishers. But it was something I always wanted to get back to and do more of. The previous murder book stories were all set in Vancouver, British Columbia, where I was living at the time, except for one, which was set in Kelowna, where I had lived as a teenager. With the new one, I've moved the location to Nova Scotia, Halifax, Nova Scotia specifically, which is on the other coast of the country, which is where I live now. Because for me, I like the idea of when I'm writing something that I write a story that could only take place where I'm living at the time. Mm-hmm. And I like the idea of just being able to hop in my car, drive out and take reference photos for the artists. You know, like if you look at some of those old murder book stories, you know, there's one I did with Johnny Christmas that's set in a park called Trutlake Park, where you could literally look at a panel and find the specific tree in the background of a panel. And there's something about that that I like that makes it feel real. And it's kind of like that, you know, Marvel takes it to the fantastic with the world outside their window.
Right.
This is much more like the world outside my very own window. So I moved this story and any subsequent murder book stories will be set here in Nova Scotia, unless I end up moving again, which, God, I hope not. But yeah, they're all, you know, this one, while the other ones were all short stories, I've sort of wanted to, I didn't want to come back and do the same. So what I want to do is longer. So this is a standalone original graphic novel is not, you know, it's like 50 pages longer, I think, than the previous longest story. So I wanted to tell longer stories. I've done a lot of short stories. I just want to kind of graduate up to longer stories. And the hope is that if this Kickstarter does well enough, which it seems to be on track to doing, we want to come back like once a year, do a standalone murder book, hardcover, graphic novel. And so now, I don't want to get too ahead of myself, but that's the hope, that's the plan.
Right, exactly. Good Lord willing. Now, you don't have to have read any of the previous stuff, right?
Like, no, when
you talk
absolutely.
About murder book, it's more just an idea of the tone is going to be similar to kind of the world they're setting, not necessarily the characters or the narrative.
Absolutely. It's and again, like just going like using Twilight Zone as an episode or an example, sorry. You know, each Twilight Zone episode is a standalone thing. Every murder book story is a standalone story. Like all those five pages, they're all standalone. This graphic novel is standalone. The next one we do will be a standalone. I like being able to, and in writing comics, you don't get this opportunity often, I think, where you can tell a contained story, where you don't have to worry about continuity,
right,
or whether or not your readers, you know, have read the previous three issues or what have you. They were always designed to be a series that you could just pick up. You could find an issue at a flea market or whatever, pick it up, read it, even though it's issue four or what have you, and enjoy it on its own. And that's the same with this graphic novel. It's completely standalone. You don't have to have read any murder book in the past to hop on this.
Yeah, and one thing that is a continuation, however, is your artist on the series, right? Somebody you've worked with on murder book content before. Can you talk a little bit about his work and the other collaborators on this project?
Sure. So Lisandro Estherin, who's drawing this, we didn't actually work on a murder book story, but we worked on a book for Boom Studios called The Last Contract.
Oh, gotcha.
Which is a crime story.
Gotcha. Okay.
So we've done crime stuff before. So he and I did The Last Contract to Boom Studios in 2015. So it's like 5 years ago. And it was a great collaboration. It's a funny thing because I pitched that book to them without an artist. They had the way that Boom works is like they'll, if they like the idea, you develop it and then you bring in an artist later to work with. And I honestly thought they were going to cancel the book because I think they showed me something like 25 artists and I kept nixing them all. And, wow. And plenty of them were great. Plenty of them were talented, but they just weren't the right fit.
Right.
But the second I saw Lisandro's work, I was just like, this is it. Like he's got a very European sort of sensibility. He does his black and white ink wash pages that are just a beauty to behold. His sense of like light and shadow, it's just absolutely incredible. And his sense of just like tone and mood is so good. And it's weird because he has like a slight cartoony edge to his art, but it can feel incredibly menacing as well. But when we were working on Last Contract, I would see the black and white pages coming in before they were colored. And I loved them. And the colorist did a great job. Coloring the Last Contract. So this is not a knock at all against the Colors in the Last Contract. But I was always wish that we could have done a black and white book of his stuff just so people could see that original ink wash, those original ink wash pages. So when this, when I finished writing the script for this, I had him in mind while I was writing it the entire time. I have like all the chapter breaks are like these what's the term I'm looking at? I'm blanking. They're like landscapes, basically, landscape paintings that bring you into each scene. And I knew that he would just be able to nail them. I had his art in the back of my mind while I was writing it, but I hadn't talked to him about working on it. I didn't know if he was available. But weirdly, at the same time, a publisher from Argentina had picked up The Last Contract for a translated edition and had invited Lissandra and I to do an interview, you know, just through email. So we did an interview and got to talking again. And, you know, I asked if he'd be interested in this. I sent him the script and, you know, thankfully he was down. He's interested in doing it. So, you know, here we are. And it's a, you know, the pages he's been doing have just looked incredible. The cover he did is so spooky and atmospheric. I love it. Yeah, he's been an absolute pleasure to work with. He's so great.
So how long have you been working on this project? Because like you yourself said, you've been pretty busy doing Marvel work and some work for some other publishers for the last few years. And now you're, you know, dipping your toe back in the creator owned. How long have you been working on Catch and Release?
I started writing the script for this back in May when the pandemic got into full swing. A lot of books I was working on were put on hold. So I was kind of just sitting around for a while. And I'd always complained that I didn't have time to work on creator-owned. And I knew that if I didn't actually take advantage of the time I was given, I would hate myself forever for not doing that. And so, you know, I think a bunch of my books got put on hold on a Friday, and Monday morning I got up and just started working on Catch and Release. And I worked on that for about 2 months, I think. I wrote the script over the course of about 4 weeks, and then I revised it. I went through and reworked it just repeatedly and just kind of kept beating it to shape until it was like nice and tight. It was exactly what I wanted. So yeah, it's the longest I think I've spent, if you break it down, hours spent by page, it's the longest I think I've ever spent on a project in terms of hours per page out of any project I think I've ever worked on. So yeah, May through June, I worked on that and sort of tried getting a couple other creator-owned projects going, or at least started in the early stages.
Well, being that's how you started out self-publishing, and you know, oftentimes you're self-publishing, you're working without a net, there's no editor, there's no support staff, you're really doing it all yourself. And then you really have made a name for yourself writing some great series over at Marvel where you do kind of have that support. You have an editor and, you know, working in the X-Men family books, you have other writers and you guys are, you know, in a room breaking stories sometimes, you know, for events and things like that. Mm-hmm. And now you're coming back to creator-owned, having all that experience under your belt. Was it different? Did you feel like, hey, I have even more skills now, more experience. It's made me a better writer and I can bring that over to the creator-owned side?
Yeah, I think so. I think working with editors has made me more open to like questioning what I'm doing and why a scene needs to be in there. Because, you know, when I'm working on a Marvel book, you have to be able to justify why every word is in that script, why every scene is in there, why, you know, this character is doing that. And before I used to just be like, you know, I wouldn't have to rationalize it. I'd be like, this is just the way the story is going to go. I do think though, going back to creator owned, I do have more opportunities to be like, you know, maybe I can't explain right now why this scene is important, but I feel in my gut that this scene needs to be in this script. And so I'm going to put it in there and we'll see in the end. And there's like little bits that I think later on I was able to recognize, you know, like in the last con, or I don't know why I'm keeping on the last contract. I guess we're just talking about in catch and release. You know, part of this guy stealing the car is he's doing this just to see if he can still do it. And it wasn't until I'd finished writing the script and was doing my third or fourth revision, I was like, oh, you son of a bitch. Like, that's in there because it's me writing this to see if I can still do it.
Right.
And that's just a little bit of myself that's in there. But it was one of those things where I'm like, why doesn't he just steal a car because he wants to steal it? Why is there this motivation? But I couldn't vocalize it until right. I'd read it a few times. I'm like, oh, Christ. You know, I'm just putting myself in there. But and I think it, you know, for me, it emotionally connects me more to the story that I'm writing. So I think, yeah, I'm bringing more skills from having worked with editors. I'm questioning myself more, but I am trying to get away with a little bit of that. Just it's in there because my gut feels it's right.
Right. And really, I mean, creator, and like you said, especially the fact that you know, self-contained stories, it kind of exercises different muscles. But one of the reasons I love your writing so much, I loved it on Extermination. I loved it when you were doing the X-Force series before the whole House of X, Dawn of X. Mm-hmm. Even though we're talking about these fantastical characters with these incredible powers, your stuff is always grounded, which, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, does that come from the fact that you've always loved to work in the crime genre where things are more street level and they are more realistic and more grounded? You know, you take it to the extreme with setting them in the places where you live. Because you don't always get that. Sometimes, you know, with a superhero story, it's out there, it's fantastical, and that's great. But I love that your stuff always does feel grounded from the dialogue to the situations they're in. It always has a sense of realism to it. And I love that about your writing.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I think for me, that is like, I always need to know, I'm always more interested, I guess I should say, in the personal stakes. And what it means to like the individual characters going throughout. And it's just, you know, it hits a point where it's just really hard to care about the end of the world again. Right. But you certainly care if like your best friend just got shot and killed, in a weird way, it doesn't make logical sense, but it emotionally, it's more of a gut punch, right? It's a bigger story for the person than going out there and saving the world, you know, over and over again. So for me, it's always like, I'm always trying to figure out the personal stakes. And it's funny because I always worry that that's a liability with me sometimes, is that I take things and ground them so often rather than, you know, having some sort of new intergalactic threat that's coming to Earth and all of humanity will be wiped out. Even like, you know, I do the time travel stuff like in X-Force, it's still like the whole thing in X-Force is, you know, Kid Cable is worried about his whole timeline being wiped out, mm-hmm. but he was really worried about his timeline being wiped out because, you know, the love of his life was going to die. And that was it wasn't his whole world was going to be gone. It was her. And in a way, she was his whole world, I guess. And that was the driver for him. So, yeah, it's just a way. It's just the only way that I can invest myself, I think, in the story is to find those sort of stakes and make sure that, you know, that's expressed through the characters.
Yeah, and I can't wait to see the way it's expressed with the characters for Catch and Release. I'm very interested. You know, I love the kind of story structure that you're describing, you know, where you get that event and then we flash back. How did they get there? What are their motivations? And then what are the consequences? I mean, those are my favorite kind of stories because they're grounded and they're relatable. Because like I said, even I've never been in a situation like this, but I've had, you know, momentous events in my life looking back where I can see how did I get there and what happened after? And so mm-hmm. that's kind of our in to the story.
Yeah. Well, thanks, man. Hopefully your listeners dig it as well. Yeah. I'm super proud of the work that we're all doing here on the book. And like I said, you know, hopefully this is just the first one of many. You know, my hope is that we'll be back next year with another.
Yeah, and so just to let everybody know, the original goal was $10,000. That's already been met. So just like with, you know, other Kickstarters where we've done spotlights, I want to remind everybody, if you pledge and it's not funded, you don't actually end up getting the project. That's not the case here. If you make a pledge for Ed's campaign, you're 100% going to get Catch and Release. It's already been funded. As we're recording this, $18,000, so almost to the first stretch goal of $20,000. So why don't you let Ed, why don't you let everybody know about what some of the tiers are and what the stretch goal rewards are when it does hit that $20,000?
Sure. So some of the tiers right now, there's the, you know, for folks who are just into digital, not into having a physical copy, there's a digital version of the book available. The first physical tier is a hardcover copy of the book. I think like one of the things that was important to me going into this, I wanted to have things reasonably priced. I didn't want anyone to feel like we were gouging them on the prices. So, you know, the hardcover book is only $22, which I think is quite reasonable. And then from there you can get an edition that's autographed. We have an autographed book plate that Lissandra and I both signed that will come with the book. Above that, I think the next tier is I will do a sketch on a book plate for you, and Lissandra and I both sign it. Then there's one where you can have Lissandra's sketch, which is almost gone, I believe. That one is almost sold out. Then we have some original art, which is reasonably priced. I believe it's like $250 for original art, which also still includes the book. You get the book with that. We still have some script reviews left where you can have a script review by myself. Or there's still one at the time that I'm talking right now for Kelly Thompson will do a script review for you. She's written Captain Marvel, is writing Black Widow right now. She's an incredible writer. Trying to think if we have any beyond that. There's a retail level for retailers who want to get involved. So we, you know, I like the idea that Kickstarter is more intimate, is between the reader and the creator. But I didn't want to cut out the retailer, so we made sure to have a retailer tier there. And for the retailer tier, I'll also film like a 30 to 60 second video sort of promoting their store, letting people know they can get the book at their store and they can use it on their social media or whatnot. In terms of stretch goal, the first one, which we're less than $2,000 away from right now, is we're going to put together a digital director's cut of the book. So that is the full script, all the thumbnails, all the pencils, all the final ink wash pages, a lot of the reference materials that I, like a lot of the reference photos I've taken, we'll be putting in there with context for the photos, like what they are. Yeah, you know, like there's a scene in there where they go to a bar, which is a bar that I hang out at a lot. So, you know, I'll provide that sort of context in there. Hassan, who is our letterer, is going to do like some process on the logo and his approach to the lettering and such on it. So it's really just like a giant book for process junkies. It's going to, my guess is it'll come in right around 250 pages. Right now, wow. we're sort of teetering around 200 pages. So it's a lot of extra stuff. It's like, you know, if you love seeing behind the scenes, if you love seeing how the books are made and each step along the way, then this is, I think, something that people will dig. And that stretch goal, if we hit it, everybody who's backed the book from digital tier right up to retailer, what have you, gets the digital director's cut for free, added onto the thing. So there's no extra cost, obviously, because it's a digital reward. There's no worry about extra shipping or any of that sort of jazz. And so right now we're just focusing on that. If we hit that, then we'll roll out the next stretch goal.
Yeah, I think that's fabulous. I think that, you know, the script reviews from you and Kelly, I'm a big fan of Kelly's work, as well as yours. So I think those are invaluable for people that are trying to break in, trying to become writers. And this back matter, this behind the scenes stuff, you know, even if you're not able to get one of the script reviews, you know, seeing this process and the way other people work, I think is really valuable for people. You know, whether you're self-publishing on Kickstarter, you're trying to break in, you know, to one of the established publishers, this is the kind of thing that you need to do, that you need to see, that you need to emulate. So I think it's has a lot of value to that for sure.
Yeah, well, let's hope we get there.
So that's going to do it for Catch and Release. I really want to thank Ed for his time in talking to us kind of about the process and this project and kind of his secret origin. I know that you have finished your run for the Dawn of X and then sort of the ongoing X-Men stuff with New Mutants, which Vita Ayala is going to be taking over. And you, I believe you have other work in the pipeline for Marvel that you can't talk about yet, but are there any other upcoming projects that you can mention that you want to plug?
I wish I could. I'm like, you know, the pandemic really kind of messed my whole timeline up. I was in a place where I actually was going to be just slowing down on work a little bit before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of actually letting a few projects I was working on end before seeking out new projects. And of course the pandemic hit and then all new projects got delayed,
right.
Which meant that my starting on new stuff got delayed. But yeah, you know, unfortunately there's nothing I can talk about. I've got, you know, I guess I can talk about the, I have a short story coming up in Wolverine, Black, White, and Blood issue 4, which is a 10-page story where I have Wolverine duking it out with some great white sharks and some other people, but the great white sharks is the highlight for me. And then, yeah, I've got a couple projects coming up for Marvel. I have a one-shot that's coming out in March. I believe it's coming out in March. It should be solicited real soon. I think folks who've been reading stuff of mine for the last year will probably be excited to see it. But, I, you know, that's about as much of a tease as I can give. And then I have two series that probably won't be out until later spring of 2021, again, because the pandemic just delayed everything. And just a few other things that are sort of in the infancy stages right now that will be coming out through a couple other publishers, actually. So, like, a lot of stuff. I feel like I'm vague tweeting here almost, but right. because yep. I can't talk about it. But, yeah, I'm still working. I just handed off a script about 2 hours ago, and in the process of working another one, it's got to go out the door in a couple of days.
Well, I look forward to finding out what it is. We always mention your stuff on the show just because it's so good. One other thing I just thought of that I wanted to ask you.
Sure.
I've thought about this before. You know, like I said, you were part of the X universe for a long time at Marvel, and then, you know, through House of X and Powers of X and Dawn of X with New Mutants. And that's really kind of a tight-knit group that was being run there by Jonathan Hickman. You know, even though you're working on different books, I'm sure you writers were talking a lot. But then on the other end of things, you had Ghost Rider, which is, you know, so much of a standalone. Do you prefer one of over the other? Do you like working on stuff that's sort of, you know, insular, even though it's part of the bigger Marvel universe? Or do you like being kind of in the family of books, either, you know, X-Men or Avengers or what have you?
I don't know that I have like a strong preference, to be honest, but if, you know, I think I would lean slightly towards being more insular. Mm. I like, I don't know. I'm just a loner sometimes, I guess. But I do enjoy working as part of groups like that. Like, you know, there's, you know, working on the X-Men stuff, being in those rooms is really fun. There's a lot of really cool stuff that comes out of there. So it's really a toss-up for me, which I know is kind of a non-answer, but yeah, I think slightly lean towards like sort of insular, you know, books. And I tend to prefer, you know, fewer characters as well, you know, as few characters I can get away with.
Yeah, it sounds good. And that makes total sense. You know, you do one thing for a while, you kind of start to get a little tired of it, switch it up, it can keep those creative juices flowing for sure.
Absolutely.
Well, again, Ed, I want to thank you for your time. Anything else that you want to say to our listeners? At the very least, we probably should let them know where they can find you online.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter. I'm just Ed Brisson, so EDBRISSON. That's about it. I guess I have a newsletter if you want to subscribe to the newsletter, which is if you go to my website at edbrisson.com. Just click on the newsletter link, subscribe there. I usually try not to inundate people with too many newsletters. Right now I'm sending them out once every 2 weeks. And I am actually sending out free PDFs of some of the older Murder Book stories along with my newsletter. So, you know, folks are curious to check out some of those old Murder Book stories, just subscribe to my newsletter, get it for free every couple of weeks. I'll be sending out one this week. But yeah, I think other than those two things, you know, just check out the Kickstarter and that's about it. You know, And hopefully, you know, stay tuned to my Twitter to see what those announcements are that I can't talk about right now.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, everybody, there's a link to the Kickstarter in the show notes. I'll also put a link to Ed's website as well as his Twitter so you can follow him there. So again, Ed, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. And as this is being released, everybody, there's 2 weeks to go on the campaign. And like I said earlier, it's already fully funded. So you go, you pledge, you know you're going to get catch and release. So as always, want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.